Next case is 20-5092, Farrell versus Sim Group Corporation. Counsel for appellant, please make your appearance and proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Rachel Cowan on behalf of both Sim Group and Cypress. May it please the court, counsel. The plaintiff, Robert Farrell, worked as a pipeline inspector for Cypress Energy, which classified him as exempt from overtime under the FLSA. Before commencing employment, Mr. Farrell signed an arbitration agreement promising to arbitrate on an individual basis any disputes or claims for unpaid overtime that arise out of or relate in any way to his employment. After signing that arbitration agreement, Cypress assigned him to perform inspection services at a pipeline owned and operated by its customer, SEM Group. Despite this promise, Mr. Farrell brought an FLSA claim directly against SEM Group in federal court, alleging that SEM Group failed to pay him owed overtime, and further sought to represent a collective of all the inspectors assigned to any SEM Group pipeline, regardless of who their actual employer was, who were paid a day rate. Shortly after Mr. Farrell brought that claim, Cypress Energy, which actually employed Mr. Farrell, moved to intervene pursuant to Rule 24, and that intervention was granted. Cypress then moved in its own right as a party and signatory to the arbitration agreement to compel the entire dispute into arbitration. SEM Group joined in that motion, moving as the non-signatory defendant in the lawsuit also to compel the dispute into arbitration. Those motions were denied by the district court, and in so doing, the district court made three errors. First, the court conflated Cypress and SEM Group's motion as raising the same issues. They do not. Cypress is a signatory to the arbitration agreement. And as this court has previously recognized, once Cypress was granted intervention, it became a full participant in the lawsuit and was to be treated just as if it were an original party.
How does Cypress's right to move to enforce the agreement, how does that interact with paragraph 5 of the agreement, which does not allow Cypress to seek to represent the interests of another in the arbitration, or, and it reserves to the court the interpretation as it relates to collective actions? In other words, the argument could be made that Cypress, yes, Cypress is invoking its own right under the agreement, but actually all it's doing is acting on behalf of SEM Group.
So, Your Honor, I believe that what you are addressing is twofold. First, I believe that provision 5 addresses whether or not Mr. Farrell could join a collective action, even though he were not the plaintiff, meaning that would be for a federal court to decide, because under the FLSA, it's an opt-in procedure, and therefore he could receive a notice in a case where he was not a party. And I believe the court would decide then, similar to JP Morgan Chase in the Fifth Circuit, that he could not participate. But the arbitration agreement has a delegation clause.
I understand that, but subsection C of paragraph 5 says the employee or the employer shall only submit their own individual claims in arbitration and will not seek to represent the interests of any other person. That's what I'm talking about. Why couldn't it be argued that Cypress is not actually invoking their own interests, but is in fact acting for SEM Group, and therefore that paragraph also speaks about judicial interpretation of the effect of paragraph 5. So why could the argument not exist? And this is what I want your response to. Why couldn't the argument exist that Cypress is not, in fact, in substance, invoking its own interests, but in fact is seeking to represent SEM Group?
So we move to compel arbitration under Section 4 of the Federal Arbitration Act, which only requires that we be a party aggrieved, and we are aggrieved. And whether SEM Group is also aggrieved or whether it also has interest in compelling arbitration is irrelevant to the inquiry. We were entitled under Section 4 of the Federal Arbitration Agreement as a party aggrieved to compel the dispute into arbitration. And at that point, the agreement tripped into the AAA incorporation and the delegation clause, which assigns to the arbitrator the power to rule on his or her own jurisdiction, including any objection with respect to the existence, scope, or validity of the arbitration agreement.
I understand that's your position. All I'm trying to get you to do is give me your best response to what is not your position. Because as I understand it, one could reasonably argue that the effect of what you are doing is actually representing SEMGROUP. So for a moment, indulge me and assume that that is the argument that is being made. Why doesn't that argument have any merit? And what authority do you have to support it would not have any merit, that one could say that the actual effect of what you're doing is seeking to represent SEMGROUP's interests? And if it is, that the provision in the agreement of paragraph 5 would require that the court sort it out.
So no one moved under Section 5 of the agreement for the court to sort it out. Both SEMGROUP and Cyprus moved under the Federal Arbitration Act to compel arbitration, and both parties argued that the delegation clause that was incorporated by reference to the AAA rules required the arbitrator to sort it out, and that was our right. So too was our right as both parties, SEMGROUP and Cyprus, whose interests are aligned. And I think, Your Honor, just because SEMGROUP has an interest doesn't mean that Cyprus doesn't. Both parties have an interest in compelling this dispute into arbitration as a single or individual claim. They are not mutually exclusive, nor is there any requirement they be mutually exclusive.
Well, Cyprus had counsel along those lines. If you're what I understand your argument to be, the trial court allowed Cyprus to intervene. And if the trial court was wrong was right in letting them intervene, but under the agreement to submit that to arbitration, but he was right in regards to the other company, where are you? And where are we in the status of this case?
So I do believe the court was correct in allowing Cyprus to intervene. Cyprus then had standing under Section 4 of the Federal Arbitration Act to compel the entire dispute into arbitration. And whether the claims against SEMGROUP were covered or within the scope was to go to the arbitrator.
Well, I'm saying, let's say that we find that the district court was right insofar as SEMCOR. So we say that it was right in both instances. The judge gets to decide in one, the arbitrator in the other. Where are we in this litigation?
Well, then I think you have a problem because you have conflicting determinations by the arbitrator and the court. And I do think that this court under Henry Schein doesn't have power once you say Cyprus has a right to take to the arbitrator whether the dispute with SEMGROUP is arbitrable. I don't think it can simultaneously rule on the issue. It should then stay the dispute under the Federal Arbitration Act.
Well, let me ask you this. Are you familiar with the January case, I believe, Reese versus Enterprise, where this same question is raised?
So I argued that case, and I do recall spending some time with you, Judge Baldock, and I do think they are different cases. There are overlap. We did identify them as related cases in our papers. Procedurally, they are somewhat different. In the earlier case, Reeves versus Enterprise Partners, only Enterprise Partners was the defendant. We did not, Cyprus did not move to intervene, and they're also Kestrel Services. Neither vendor moved to intervene. And the motion was no issues related to the delegation clause were raised. What is before you in January is solely whether a third party under Oklahoma law can move to compel arbitration as a non-signatory under the estoppel doctrine for interdependent misconduct.
Do we have to wait until that opinion comes out, or can we proceed on with this?
Well, so if you determine that the delegation clause doesn't apply here and that the court could or should have reached the merits as to whether SEMGROUP as a third party non-signatory could compel arbitration, then I do think that both cases have to come together or that case has to come first. It's certainly your discretion which one you rule in, but they would then be raising the exact same issue. However, you could delegate or compel the the district court to compel this case into arbitration under the delegation clause, it would then be for the arbitrator to decide, for example, whether the text of the agreement, which also says a party aggrieved by the alleged failure, neglect, or refusal of another, which says that the parties agree that any dispute or controversy relating to the employment is arbitrable. The arbitrator could rule there on the text of the agreement. The arbitrator could also rule on the estoppel before you in the Reeves case. So it just depends which way you would go in this case, whether you have to wait.
Thank you.
Counsel, do you agree that if we get beyond the delegation clause issue, does our decision in Belknap control the analysis of whether Mr. Farrell's claim against the SEM Group is arbitrable?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't believe that Belknap would control. In Belknap, I don't believe this court actually ever reached the Henry Schein issue, and it decided estoppel under Utah law. And so I don't believe Belknap controls here at all.
Well, you mentioned the estoppel and interdependence issue. Wouldn't that be a question of Oklahoma law?
It is, and Belknap does not address Oklahoma law. I believe, if my recollection is correct, it addresses Utah law.
No, I understand that. I probably should have said, does Belknap control our obligation to look to state law?
Actually, the Supreme Court's decision in Arthur Anderson says that when the third party moves to the non-signatory, so that would control for SEM Group's motion. It doesn't, state law doesn't apply at all to Cypress's motion. If Cypress is a party that is aggrieved, this court is required to compel, or the trial court is compelled to arbitrate Mr. Farrell to arbitrate his dispute. And then it simply becomes an issue of scope for the arbitrator as to whether the claims against SEM Group can be joined. Does that answer your question, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Okay. Your Honor, I see I just have 2.5 minutes left, and I'd like to reserve that for my rebuttal.
That's fine. Counselor Appellee, we'll hear from you, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Rex Birch, and I represent Mr. Farrell, and may it please the court. Judge Frizzell correctly rejected SEM Group's efforts to claim the benefits of somebody else's bargain. SEM Group has no arbitration agreement with Mr. Farrell. Instead, SEM Group hopes to glom onto an agreement between Farrell and Cypress Environmental, sometimes called TEER.
Counsel, then let me ask you the same question I did opposing counsel. If we assume that the trial court got it right in regards to SEM Court, but it got it wrong in regards to Cypress. In other words, they're a party now and they are entitled to arbitration. I'm just assuming. Where are we in the litigation in this case? Because there's the joint and several liability that the court found on the basis of letting Cypress in.
So SEM Group would not be entitled to arbitrate because there is no arbitration agreement that requires Mr. Farrell to arbitrate with SEM Group. The folks at TEER, if Mr. Farrell ever elected to bring a claim against them, which he has not and will not ever bring a claim against them under the FLSA, they would be entitled to arbitrate that dispute. But If the court correctly found that SEM Group has no arbitration agreement with Mr. Farrell, the case proceeds in court. So,
we get to the equitable estoppel issue.
We do, which is the only way that they have ever really tried to enforce this agreement. I realize that they've taken a slightly different tact on appeal, and I get all that. But the thrust of their argument, certainly in the district court, and the thrust of their argument outside of the delegation clause is equitable estoppel. In seeking to grab the benefits of the Cypress agreement, SEM Group relied exclusively on an appeal to equitable estoppel. And then, the folks at Cypress joined them in that. And they claim, that Mr. Farrell should be equitably estopped because of some defensive positions that they take. And we'll talk about those in a minute. But the bottom line issue is that they cannot show that Judge Frizzell abused his discretion in declining to apply equitable estoppel, which is the standard as we see it.
Is the law clear in Oklahoma on equitable estoppel and that doctrine?
Yes, under Oklahoma law, certainly. All principles of equity are considered to be discretionary exercise. The merit versus merit case talks about that. That's 73 P3D 878 at 882. And then, of course, the Tenth Circuit has long held that the application of equitable estoppel is a discretionary exercise, and that is reviewed for abuse of discretion.
I guess part of the question I was raising is, has the Oklahoma Supreme Court defined the contours of equitable estoppel? We have the Oklahoma Court of Civil Appeals. I think there are two decisions that have been operative here, but has the Oklahoma Supreme Court spoken to that issue? That's relevant here.
Yes, they have. And when the Oklahoma Supreme Court itself has talked about equitable estoppel, they have adopted the principles of equitable estoppel that are, traditional in nature. What the Supreme Court in Arthur Anderson called, traditional principles of contract law, traditional concepts of equitable estoppel. The Oklahoma Supreme Court has never adopted the strands of arbitration-specific estoppel advanced by appellants, nor is there any precedential opinion that adopts either of those strands of equitable estoppel.
Well, I mean, the other way to say that is they have not spoken on that issue, right? It's not that they've rejected that there are arbitration-specific lines of estoppel. Is that right?
So I understand that argument, but I disagree with it.
That's really sort of a factual or descriptive question. I mean, have they spoken to have they rejected that there are different strands of equitable estoppel? Well, I'm just trying to I'm just trying to understand that I know.
I guess I view that as two separate questions. Have they addressed equitable estoppel?
Yes.
Answer to that question, absolutely. Yes, they have. They have done so in the arbitration context.
Okay.
Have they specifically rejected these other lines of equitable estoppel? No, they have not done that. But they have said, this is what equitable estoppel is in the arbitration context. And then I as I appreciate it, appellant's theory would be, yeah, but there's these other flavors as well. And even if they aren't traditional principles of estoppel, you should still be persuaded to adopt them for Oklahoma, which, and we can talk about these reasons as well. We don't think it's appropriate, because if you look at those Oklahoma opinions, they're all relying on federal opinions back, prior to Arthur Anderson from the Supreme Court, when, the federal notions of expanding arbitration were in vogue. But that, of course, has been since rejected by the Supreme Court and Arthur Anderson. And, there's a reason why, the appellants cite to the Fifth Circuit case in Grigson as opposed to the MS Dealer case from the 11th Circuit, which the Fifth Circuit said it was adopting. And that's because the MS Dealer decision has a red flag next to it in Westlaw, letting you know that it's been gutted. And the Grigson case only has a yellow flag to let you know that it's been damaged pretty badly.
Well, I'm not going to be guided in how I resolve this case by Westlaw's flag,
sure.
I assure you. But my question for you, has there ever been an attempt to certify on the equitable estoppel issue to the Oklahoma Supreme Court to have them speak on that issue?
Not that I am aware of. As I recall, it might have been Judge Baldock that asked us about that during Reeves, but it came up during Reeves. But to my knowledge, there has never been an attempt to certify, although you certainly could, but I don't think that's necessary, right? Arthur Anderson tells
us. Is it your position then that we don't have to resolve that issue in this case?
I think it has been resolved.
Well, Arthur whether Anderson, you think that or not, the question is, does this court think that it's been resolved?
Of course it is.
Okay. So it's got to be resolved either by us or by the Oklahoma Supreme Court.
Right. And I guess if I'm saying if I was proposing a way to resolve that issue, I would say, what did the Supreme Court say? The Supreme Court said you look to, quote, traditional principles of state contract law. Then you go to Oklahoma and you say, what is their traditional formulation of estoppel? There's a case on that. It's the Taylor case from the Oklahoma Supreme Court. It sets out the version of equitable estoppel that we all learned in law school and that everybody always talks about and that parties would kind of understand just as general background law that people would kind of expect to apply to their contracts. It requires that there be some sort of affirmative misrepresentation by Mr. Farrell, that the folks at SEM Group have reasonably relied on that affirmative misrepresentation to their detriment. And they don't even pretend that they can make the traditional format of equitable estoppel. They eschew that.
And it's your view that the Oklahoma Supreme Court in the arbitration context has spoken to this issue. And so that's what we should be guided by. And that the flavors, I think was the word you used, found in the Oklahoma Court of Civil Appeals are just that, and that they aren't binding on us in terms of what Oklahoma law is. I just am trying to make sure I understand your position.
Yes, I certainly do say that. And Oklahoma agrees with me. I mean, they're all non-published opinions, which under Oklahoma law means they are persuasive only. And, you know, the Oklahoma Supreme Court has had chances, in my opinion, to adopt these separate flavors of arbitration specific estoppel, and it hasn't done so.
Okay, we've spent a lot of time talking about SEM Group. I want to talk, why isn't Cypress or whatever word formulation of that you want to use, why couldn't they, under their theory, why couldn't they as an aggrieved party act on their own? I mean, they're in this action. They are a party to this action. They are party to that agreement. Why can't they invoke that agreement and take it into invoke the principles under that agreement and the terms under that agreement, take it into arbitration, and then it becomes for the arbitrator to decide whether SEM Group can join or not?
Because they're not a party to the controversy, to use Judge Ginsburg language from.
Well, they're in this action. I mean, the court let them in this action, and they're in why, and they are therefore a full party in this litigation. So why can't they stand on their rights in this litigation?
Sure, but there's still no claims against them. There's still no claim asserted against them. Nobody is alleging anything against them. Nobody is claiming they did anything wrong. They were allowed to intervene and became a party because they said they have an interest in this litigation.
Well, they do. Right? And the fact that there's no claim against them doesn't mean that they, as they charted out in their brief, at least arguably, that they are going to be exposed here. And if they're going to be exposed to some liability, ultimately, then why can't they seek to have that issue worked out in arbitration, despite the fact that they're not named in your complaint? Why can't they do that? And you seem quizzical. I'm pretty sure I read in their reply brief a whole lot of talk about the fact that what the level of their exposure is.
But that exposure isn't because of something that Mr. Farrell did. right?
Well, their argument is that they paid Mr. Farrell. Their argument is ultimately their failure, the failure to treat Mr. Farrell appropriately under the Fair Labor Standards Act will fall at their feet. And whether you have chosen to name them as a defendant or not does not impact their ultimate liability. Therefore, the theory is that they want to stand on their rights under the agreement, and the court let them in, which means that the court thinks that they're a party to this action. So I guess I'm trying to understand why doesn't that make sense? I mean, why do the and perhaps I missed it in terms of the definitive authority, but why do they have to have a claim against them? If they have an interest that they think is at issue here, and they agree, the language of the delegation clause is pretty darn broad, why can't they just invoke it and say, let's work it out in arbitration?
Well, to be sure, Cyprus says they have an agreement with Farrell and Farrell has a delegation clause. But the question in this case is not whether or not Mr. Farrell agreed to arbitrate with somebody. It's whether or not he agreed to arbitrate with SEM Group.
That's what you say the question is. Yes. The point is that's a their argument is that's a conflation of the fact that there are two separate interests here, that Cyprus has an interest and SEM Group has an interest. And Cyprus wants to stand on their interests, which the court has given them a right to do by virtue of intervention.
But that's not what they're trying to do. I mean, if we look at, for example, and I want to back up just a little bit. You made reference to it earlier, but I want to look at, you know, Section 5 of the agreement, which is reprinted on page 6 of the red brief.
And was I deluding myself? I thought that was at issue here. Is
100% is at issue here. Like,
I'll talk about it, please.
Yeah. So, I mean, as you can read for yourself.
Yes.
The arbitration agreement specifically says that the folks at Cyprus will, quote, not seek to represent the interest of any other person. But that is exactly what Cyprus is trying to do. They are saying, and I'm quoting Cyprus here, that, quote, SEM Group is entitled to the protections of the arbitration agreement. That's at the supplemental appendix at 230. And there is expressly no authority under this arbitration agreement that would permit Cyprus to advance that interest. And not to gild the lily here, but the remainder of Section 5 makes it clear that that's a question for the court, because they say, you know, this paragraph gets decided by a court, a federal or district court in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which Judge Frizzell turns out is. And, quote, not by an arbitrator. So even if they could show that Judge Frizzell abused his discretion in declining to apply equitable estoppel and allow them to enforce this agreement against against Mr. Farrell, which he didn't, they can't show that he erred by addressing this subject, because according to them, that's who's supposed to resolve it. And so as we see it, this is pretty simple. There's no agreement to arbitrate with SEM Group. The fact that there is an arbitration agreement with somebody else doesn't change that. And if they want to try and claim the benefits of those other of that other person's agreement, with Cyprus's agreement, both of them need to show that can be done through equitable estoppel, additional notions of equitable estoppel, and they've failed to do so. I realize I'm over my time, Your Honor. So
any other questions from my colleagues? All right. Thank you for your argument. Ms. Cohen, you had some time reserved.
Your Honor. I'd like to come back to paragraph 5 of the arbitration agreement. And let me begin by saying, while Your Honor has asked a question that I'd like to follow up, I do want to point out that Mr. Farrell never raised paragraph 5 in the court below as the basis for why the federal court has jurisdiction to resolve the motion to compel arbitration. More importantly, paragraph 5 is the class action waiver, not the duty to arbitrate. And so it goes through in detail that you cannot bring class or collective claims or represent the interests of others when you're bringing an affirmative claim. Cypress is not bringing a claim against Mr. Farrell. It is moving to compel arbitration under a different provision of the employment agreement as an aggrieved party.
Ms. Clark, two points. One is that's not, it just doesn't talk about collective actions. The paragraph subsection C, which I read to you, says something else. It goes specifically to the notion of representing somebody else, period. That's the first thing. Second thing is, to the extent that it's ambiguous, paragraph 5 talks about who should resolve that ambiguity. And it's the court, right?
Well, I don't think it's ambiguous. I think it actually is clear that it's the class action waiver. And to read it otherwise would render void or nugatory other provisions that say that they will arbitrate their disputes. Because under your interpretation, Your Honor, paragraph 4 is meaningless. And the delegation clause is meaningless.
Why is it meaningless? Because paragraph 5 relates to other things. You could not be representing the interests of somebody else, and then the delegation clause would be in full effect. So it's not meaningless. It has effect.
Well, again, paragraph 5 is clear in that it begins by talking about the employee will not seek class action, collective action, or representative action. B talks about they will not assert class action or representative action. And C says that they shall only submit their own individual claims.
There is a colon, and it says agree that, colon. And then you just drop ellipses down to number C. And C specifically talks about employer and employee. In other words, the collective action section is in paragraph A. So the point is, it seems to me after the colon, you've got subsection C, and that speaks about a specific subject. And that subject is whether you can bring an arbitration representing someone else's interests. Does it not?
I think you've taken the second half of the sentence, or list, or ellipses, however you want to refer to it. Employee and employer should only submit their own individual claims in arbitration and will not seek to represent the interests of any other person. To me, read as a whole, that is very clear that you cannot bring a claim on behalf of someone else. We are not bringing a claim, neither Cypress nor SEM Group, against Mr. Farrell. We are simply moving to compel his claims into arbitration.
And Your Honor, it's your view that the position you've just articulated is unambiguous, and therefore there would be part of the provision that speaks to the notion of interpreting the effect would never be at issue here.
I do not believe this is ambiguous, and I would point Your Honor to the Bach versus Salt Creek case, the district court case in New Mexico, that talks about the distinction between the duty to arbitrate and the class action waiver. And I believe that is exactly what is transpiring here. I see I've run out of time, but I do have one other, I would like to address whether the Oklahoma Supreme Court has addressed, if you'll indulge me, Your Honor, the issue of estoppel. Yeah, Your Honor, I do think that in Long versus DeGreer, the Oklahoma Supreme Court has enforced an arbitration agreement by a non-signatory under a theory that is essentially estoppel. There, Mr. DeGreer was the individual broker who sold investment services to Ms. Long. First, she sued Kidder Peabody, who had an arbitration agreement. She was compelled to arbitrate her dispute. And then she tried to sue the broker personally. And the Oklahoma Supreme Court said very clearly, you cannot get around your duty to arbitrate through that artful pleading. While they did not invoke the term equitable estoppel, a clear reading of the decision is, frankly, Shakespeare's quote, a rose by any other name would smell so sweet. It is estoppel. And so I do think that the Oklahoma Supreme Court has addressed it.
All right. Thank you for your arguments. Case is submitted.